everybody. Welcome to the Spill the OT podcast. Today, we are talking about lactation and infant development. And oh my, this interview was action-packed with information. So I'm going to jump right into it. Marissa is an occupational therapist who specializes in lactation and infant feeding. She owns and operates a private practice called Lactation and Development Resources, which serves mothers perinatally and infants ages 0 to 6 months. Prenatally, she educates and empowers clients with evidence-based information about lactation, breastfeeding, and bottle feeding so that they can go into their birth as prepared as possible. Postpartum, Marissa offers holistic and integrative approaches to lactation support and feeding therapy in order to help her clients achieve their individual goals. Marissa is also passionate about helping other OTs as well as SLPs and PTs transition to specialize in this unique area of practice. She offers business consulting and mentorship for other therapists starting a lactation practice. She is also one of the co-founders of thelactationot.com. All of this information will be available in the show notes, as well as information about the Lactation OT Summit, which she will be sharing about a little bit more towards the end of this episode. And if you would like to participate in the summit, just use the code SPILLTHEOT, all one word, all capital letters, for 15% off. I am not an affiliate or getting any sort of kickback for this. This is just Marissa being kind and offering a discount to the listeners. So there's no incentive on my end, if that means anything to you. All right, so let's jump right into this interview, and I hope that you enjoy.
Hi, everyone. My name's Marissa. I'm so excited to be here today just to talk about OT and to talk about my journey towards becoming OT and my private practice today. So I guess I'll go back, all the way back to high school. So I knew I wanted to work with children in some capacity, and I thought about psychology. So when I went to college, I was a psych major, and in college, I took a lot of child development classes, and I enrolled in some healthcare policy classes too. One of my favorite classes was a maternal and infant well-being course. So it's kind of got my wheels turning about parents and children, mothers and children, secure attachment. And I started to think less about just working with children in isolation and more about working with the family. So during college, I also nannied to help pay for things that I needed and wanted. And I did that part-time. And the two families that I worked with, both moms were breastfeeding. And when they hired me, both of them had one child. And then during the course of me working with them, they both had a baby. So it was really cool to see firsthand what life is like with a newborn. And although when they had me come over, pretty much they were home on maternity leave and I was there for their older child, I ended up getting recruited to help with various breastfeeding tasks. So that was my first introduction to breastfeeding as a struggle and as something that is not easy and, you know, as natural as many of us are led to believe it is. So it really started to get my wheels turning because I saw, as you know, these moms would have little triumphs, as they would have setbacks, they would deal with nipple damage, it would be really upsetting. They would hire lactation consultants, and I was there supporting them. I always had a really good connection and bond with the families I worked with. And I would wash their medulla, pumping parts. I would bring them cold cabbage for, you know, their engorged, painful breasts if they asked me to. And, you know, now that I work in this field, I have conflicting feelings about the cabbage leaves, but that's a whole different thing. I just did whatever they told me to do to help them. And even the toddler, I realized having a toddler and an infant is a struggle because they would try and breastfeed their baby and their toddler would come and try and pull baby off the breast because they were jealous. So it was a really interesting dynamic to witness. And again, it got my wheels turning and it made me very interested in breastfeeding because it's just a very unusual phase in life for a mother. It's very different from bottle feeding. But at that time, I didn't really, I don't know, think about it further than that. I was working at my university's early childhood development center. And that was ages, I think 18 months to 5 at the time. Now they have an infant room. I liked being with the younger kids mostly. The 18 months to 3 years was sort of my favorite. group, and there were a few kids in the class with special needs, and there was one or two children who did have an autism diagnosis who were three and not speaking, and that was really interesting for me to see. I hadn't seen, you know, I hadn't worked with children up close and personal with, I guess, yeah, with autism at that young of an age. And I got to meet those children's therapists. I realized how many kinds of therapists there are for children. There's speech therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. They had special instructors. And it was cool. The family sometimes would have a social worker on board, or the caseworker was a social worker, the case coordinator for EI. And I loved how family centered, especially the OT was. She liked to involve mom in her sessions and would give them activities to do at home, to carry over what she was working on at the early learning center with her child. So I really gravitated towards OT. And I also liked the speech therapy. I thought her sessions were really fun and cute. And I sort of at that time looked at the prerequisites for both to try and figure out what that would look like going to OT school or SLP school for a master's. And I didn't want to go to SLP school because I didn't like that I would have to take so many linguistics courses. that wasn't interesting at all to me personally. So that was good that I figured that out early on. And then when I saw the OT prerequisites, anatomy, physiology, biology, human development. I had a lot of those courses already. And those were the courses that made me very excited. And those are the courses I was the most engaged with. So I figured, you know what, I'm going to pursue this. I'm going to finish out the prerequisites. I'll just apply. We'll see what happens. Worst comes to worst, I get rejected and I have to come up with plan B, but I'll go for it. So I took a year off and I worked at a preschool. It was easy to get the job there because I had the years of experience at the Early Learning Center at my university as a teaching assistant. So I worked at a preschool and that was fantastic. I became really good friends with the OT there. And we're still friends to this day. She would work with the kids in my class, and I got to really see from the teacher's perspective what that was like. Some of her recommendations were practical and helpful, and others weren't. But we had a nice relationship, so I could let her know, you know, that giving, you know, her one OT kid silly putty during circle time when I'm trying to read a book was not going to work for my class. Because then every kid in the circle wanted silly putty or whatever. And she had never really, I don't know, she hadn't taught. She'd always done one-on-one. So it was cool because we helped each other figure out what was, you know, effective and practical and what wasn't. But at that point, I was applying to OT school. I applied to 5 schools. I got into 4 out of 5 and I chose one. I went to Salus University in Philadelphia, near Philadelphia, just north. And it was fantastic. I loved it there. And in OT school, I requested a NICU placement. I loved working with babies, and I really envisioned myself maybe doing EI, but the younger side of EI, like 0 to 1. I just felt that is, I don't know, such an important time for children, for infants. And I just really felt strongly that if we can optimize development in that early period, and optimize the attachment between mom and baby, it can prevent a lot of issues down the line. So at my university at Salus, they didn't have a NICU placement. They did have a children's hospital placement, but wasn't working with babies. And that placement was really challenging. It was really hard to get. So I was a little disappointed about no NICU placement, and I was kind of thinking maybe I would try and find an OT in the NICU in Philly to shadow. I couldn't find anyone. And so I asked my fieldwork coordinator if I could in some way, somehow work with very young children. And she, you know, wasn't taking requests. You know, it was kind of, if you get a field replacement, you're lucky. And that's pretty much the norm at most OT schools. You know, it's hard to find field replacements, and you kind of get what you get. And they want you to have two very different areas, ideally, because that meets certain standards for their accreditation, I believe. I could be wrong about that. Anyway, so I ended up working at a school for children with autism, ages three to 11. I loved it. It was fantastic. At first, I wasn't super excited because it was more of, sometimes I mix up the levels. The level three, I believe, is the most significant and has the most significant impact on functioning. Whatever it was the level that was the most significant for autism. Sorry, I do mix it up a lot. But most of the kids were nonverbal. There was a lot of behavior that we had to manage to keep ourselves safe and the children safe. It was a great learning experience. And yeah, it was fantastic. And then for my second level two, actually for one of my level ones, there was an opportunity to go to a breastfeeding clinic in the area. They were taking requests because it was a special placement. And of course, they needed students who were going to be sensitive to the needs of the moms. And you know, they wanted students who were really interested and who were going to be very engaged. So I ran over there for that placement and begged for the placement. I did get the level one placement at the breastfeeding clinic, and I really loved it. It was so cool to see the other side of it, to sit in on sessions and watch the lactation consultants there work with moms with variety of issues. I was so impressed with their skills in terms of counseling mothers, trying to keep them calm, and helping mothers, you know, find their voice, advocate for themselves with their pediatricians, who often were not supportive of breastfeeding, and they were wonderful with helping moms navigate challenges. Some challenges were bigger than others. Some issues could be resolved in one session. Some would take three sessions. It was cool. And they were very sweet to involve me in the sessions as well. So if baby had torticollis, they would ask me about torticollis. Can you share with this mom maybe some activities she can do at home to help? So I did the best I could, but I didn't have a ton of experience in that, just sort of basics, what we learned in peds at that point. So I started pouring over my peds books at that placement and trying to teach myself more about infant development, since it wasn't really fully fleshed out in our peds course. That was interesting. And then I was really lucky to go back for a level two at the same breastfeeding clinic. And I spent 3 months there, which was fantastic. And the university, I think they classified it as an adult mental health placement. You don't get two peds placements. So I had the ped placement at, I guess, generally. So I had the ped placement at the School for Children with Autism, and then this was an adult mental health placement. And it was interesting because I agree that it was an adult mental health placement, but it was also a pediatric placement, really. There isn't anything quite like this where you have two patients, two clients, and you can't just focus on one. What's happening with baby affects mom, and what's happening with mom affects baby. They're this, you know, interdependent, interrelated dyad is what the lactation world calls it, the breastfeeding dyad. Yeah, so it's neat. And I love the breastfeeding clinic. We focused a lot on groups when I was there, and we did some one-on-one with moms. But lactation is it's a specialized area. So without continuing education in breastfeeding and lactation, me and the other two students who were there, we couldn't run a lactation consultation. That was not what we were there for. But we offered developmental screenings, and we had group sessions. We did have some one-on-one sessions with moms. The idea was it would be more related to mental health. And then if moms had wrist pain, back pain, we could talk more about positioning and, you know, biomechanics and things like that to try and reduce her pain and discomfort. However, I found that most moms just wanted to talk about their babies. So we ended up talking a lot about tummy time and development and play and torticollis. And to this day, I'm still friends on Facebook with a lot of those moms. I made sure not to become friends with them until fieldwork was over, but I keep in touch with a lot of those moms, which is cool to see as their kids are getting older. So I left that placement. I became really good friends with one of the IBCLCs on staff. She was younger, and we just really hit it off, and we would get lunch or dinner sometimes. And she was really encouraging and told me that, you know, she could see that I was very passionate about this area. And she said I should consider pursuing IBCLC. So I thought about it. IBCLC stands for International Board Certification in Lactation Consulting. It is it's considered the gold standard for lactation consulting, and lactation consulting isn't actually a protected term. So anyone can call themselves a lactation consultant. However, if you want to get hired in a hospital and you want to be their lactation consultant on staff, they want to see that you're board certified IBCLC. And some moms and pediatrician offices, they want to see those letters. So I really put those letters up on a pedestal, and that was maybe a goal for me one day. Although I felt overwhelmed with upcoming board exam and the need to start making money, all of that as a new OT. So I kind of put that on the back burner. I also had concerns since I was married and I knew I wanted kids. We had gotten married right before my last year of OT school, my husband and I. So I knew I wanted kids. We were waiting until after grad school. He was in law school. And I kind of worried that I would become even more passionate and engaged in the promotion of breastfeeding and, breastfeeding advocacy and breastfeeding, support, lactation consulting, only to have my own baby one day and have it be a flop and then end up formula feeding. That was a big concern of mine. I didn't want to feel hypocritical, and I didn't want to spend time and money investing in something that maybe I would not be able to do myself. I also worried that maybe I just had baby fever. I had been excited to have kids of my own for a very long time. So I thought, maybe I'll have a child of my own. I'll breastfeed my child, and then I'll be kind of over it, sick of it, and not want to talk about it professionally. So I started off at a school in Brooklyn. Yeah, in Brooklyn, New York. It was a charter school. I was the only OT there, which was a great challenge. Although since I came from a school setting, I knew how to work with teachers and collaborate. And I had OT colleagues I could lean on when I ran out of treatment ideas and strategies. So I did that for that year. And in the middle of that school year, we did get pregnant. I was very excited about it. And I sort of started pouring over the resources I had collected from the breastfeeding center. Just during my pregnancy, I watched some online classes. I really kind of felt like this was going to be my test. And I found that I was still very passionate and excited about breastfeeding for myself. So fast forward, at the end of my pregnancy, I unfortunately came down with intrahepatic cholestasis of pregnancy, ICP, which it's related to your gallbladder and a little bit to your liver. It basically becomes sluggish during the pregnancy, and you end up leaking bile salts into your bloodstream, which damage the placenta and can harm baby to the point of, this is triggering. So don't listen if this is triggering for you, but it can harm baby and lead to a stillbirth. So it's scary. And I was actually planning a home birth, and that risked me out of a home birth. I was 33 weeks and I got the diagnosis. I was extremely disappointed. And the only treatment for ICP is delivery. So they want you to deliver baby before 38 weeks and 0 days. So then I don't know if everyone knows this. Anyone who specializes in feeding or lactation knows it's harder with an early baby for a lot of reasons, which I'm happy to go into if you guys want. I'll try and make the story a bit quick though. So I knew I was going to be up for a bigger challenge because I was having an early baby. We know now that babies born before 39 weeks struggle for a lot of reasons. It used to be considered, 37 weeks, the baby's cooked and everything's fine from the medical community. Now they really are pushing more for moms to go to that at least 39 weeks, if not beyond. And from a feeding perspective, it really is better if they can go to their due date and come out when they're truly cooked and ready, because due dates are guest dates. They're not totally accurate. So I ended up with everything I didn't want in the hospital. I had an induction. They tried everything. I was there for 80 hours. I didn't want to give up on this vaginal delivery that I wanted so badly. And I was healthy aside from the cholestasis diagnosis. So my induction started at 37 plus zero, not because that was the right day for me. Everything was fine in our scans, but because it was the right day for the hospital. So that was interesting to see too. My health decisions were being dictated by what was convenient for the hospital. So again, induction started at 37 plus zero. And at 37 plus four, my daughter was born after 80-hour induction with multiple, you know, invasive strategies to induce. I didn't know what that felt like from a mom's perspective. Again, don't listen if this is triggering, but you know, I don't know if any of you are familiar, but you can look up Foley balloon, look up Cytotec, look up Pitocin, look up, breaking one's waters. The worst for me was the Foley balloon, the first Foley balloon. I had two Foley balloons, but, the whole thing was really tough and the rotations with the shift changes were really tough. So I didn't have great continuity of care, which if you look at the evidence, if you look at the research, continuity of care is a big deal in for moms when they're pregnant and then during the birth. You do see, I believe it's that you get better outcomes when it's one person, one OB, one midwife, someone that they can connect with and that they who they trust. So I didn't have that. My midwives at the hospital were changing shifts every 12 hours. And in the end, I just kind of, it was failure to progress is the word they use, which is a horrible phrase, failure to progress. So yeah, so I ended up with a C-section, not an emergency one, but a C-section. So I had a C-section. I was disappointed, but I felt like, you know, this is going to be really great if I do specialize in breastfeeding because I'm going to connect with these moms who end up with C-sections and who have long inductions in a way that I wouldn't have had I had this beautiful home birth that I was hoping for. So I tried to look at, you know, glass half full. And my little one, I made sure I got her skin to skin within the first hour because that's what the research says. Get them skin to skin within the first hour, ideally within the first few minutes after delivery in order to allow their reflexes to kick in. There are 9 stages they go through. I believe it's 9 with the breast crawl where they're using their reflexes to find the nipple and to latch on. And my poor little baby didn't know what she was doing. She was lost. She couldn't find the breast, and my doula, my well-meaning doula, shoved her on like a lot of people do who don't know about breastfeeding. Just took the back of her head and shoved her on aggressively, and I could see that that was stressing her out. I knew that wasn't the right thing, but I was, you know, kind of drugged up in recovery room, not feeling right, concerned that she wasn't latching, and we struggled for those 3 days. I felt that she had thin or missing sucking pads, which that's a fact. Babies born before 37 weeks have no sucking pads. They're missing. They form at the end of pregnancy. And then between 37, 39 weeks, they have thin sucking pads. They get slightly thicker, thicker, thicker as you get closer to due date. So I knew that that was the case. Nobody talked about her sucking pads. The lactation consultant on staff didn't know what I was talking about. When I mentioned her sucking pads, I didn't even share with them that I was an OT until we almost had CPS called on us. The hospital staff can be really insane, but basically she wasn't latching well, she wasn't feeding well, and I was telling the nurses that I thought that was the case. The lactation consultant came in the room and kept saying, "You're doing great, everything's fine," and I was telling them, "She's not swallowing. I don't hear swallows, nothing's happening." She had amazing diaper output because of the IV fluid. That you see that a lot. They go through diuresis, so they're peeing out all this extra fluid in the first 24 hours. But anyways, I knew that we weren't doing well and that we were going to hit a 10% weight loss. I told everyone who came in the room, "We're going to hit a 10% weight loss. This isn't going well. I need a pump in my room." I was hand expressing. I was doing all the things I knew to do. But I was so stressed from this long labor and the nurses were just not being communicative. At one point they took her for 4 hours and didn't tell me why. I was very upset about that. It turns out she was a little cold. They took her to warm her up. And they just didn't have the staff to bring her back, even though she was ready to come back after 90 minutes. So again, the system was working against me because that was their, whatever, that was what was best for them to wait the full 4 hours. Anyways, it was really unfortunate. We ended up with the feeding team in our room. She had a jaundice diagnosis. I was right. We hit a 10% weight loss, which is when they come in your room and start to force feed formula. Essentially, and tell you breastfeeding is not going well, you need to give formula. What they should do is have mom expressing as much as possible and start with giving everything mom is able to express and maybe not give formula if she can express enough. I was, again, not expressing enough at that time, although I was trying, I was hand expressing and pumping every 2 to 3 hours. Anyway, so they wanted to do this jaundice protocol where they were giving her formula every 2 hours, 20 ml. And I was expressing about 5 ml, 3 to 5 ml every 2 hours with my pump. So I said, okay, why don't I give her the whatever colostrum I'm expressing, you know, 5 ml, and then let's give her 15 ml of formula. And they said, absolutely not. That's not what our protocol is. And then I said, it's the same number of calories, ml to ml, colostrum to formula, and colostrum has, you know, what's the word for it? A laxative effect. And the way you treat jaundice is you get babies to poop. That's the treatment. They need to eat, they need to poop out the bilirubin. So that's ideal, right? If you can't give all colostrum, give a mix. That's the gold standard. That would be the gold standard. That's against our protocol. So again, they were talking about potentially calling CPS on us. They weren't listening to me. And at that point, that's when I said, this is ridiculous. I'm a healthcare professional myself. You are not, what you are recommending is not evidence-based. This is my baby. Oh, and then I hear, oh, you're an OT. My daughter gets OT. I know a lot about sensory processing. And like the tune started to change once they knew I was a healthcare professional. They started treating me with more respect, which made me angry because all moms deserve to be treated with respect, no matter how much education they have. And also my midwife had come in, one of my home birth midwives had come to visit me, which was very nice of her. And she helped advocate. She told the feeding team, you're not listening to this mom. She's not saying she's not going to give 20 ml every 2 hours. She's saying she's going to do a combination. So we had phototherapy treatment with bilirubin lights. I was doing this combination for 16 hours. We didn't sleep. The sleep deprivation is wild. I had no idea. People tell you you're going to be exhausted. I was beyond exhausted. So was my husband. Anyway, so I went through my own struggles. We ended up seeing 4 IBCLCs who all missed her tongue tie and lip tie. I thought she had a tongue tie and lip tie, and I felt like a crazy person. At that time, we were living in New York, so I couldn't go back to Philly to the breastfeeding clinic that I had done my fieldwork at. They were experts in tongue tie, and they would have picked up on it, you know, no problem. I even considered driving 3 hours to them, but I didn't want to drive that far with a newborn. So I had to help myself because nobody had any ideas for me except just stay on nipple shield and keep pumping. So it was really a challenge, and I was able to get myself off of triple feeding, off of the nipple shield. And by 6 weeks we were doing okay. But she was eating way too much, way too frequently, 16 to 18 times a day, 45 plus minute feedings, which is wild. It should be 8 to 12 times about. And the feedings at that point, by almost 2 months, should get shorter for breastfeeding for sure. So I knew that there was still something wrong, but I just kind of attributed it to her still being early, her having some torticollis that we were working through. And then it wasn't until my mom came to visit where she said, Marissa, this is crazy. This is, you are living in your glider. You have no life. Where I was like, I finally decided I'm just going to go to the top oral surgeon in Long Island and see what he says about the tongue and lip, because that's all I can think of at this point. That's the only, you know, stone unturned. And I felt silly because I was going to have to pay him $200 to have him tell me that I was wrong. But I went in and he said, you're absolutely right. She has a lip tie and a tongue tie, and I think it's really getting in your way. And he asked, you know, who are the IBCLCs you saw? I listed some names. And he was like, yeah, this happens a lot, you know, where they don't know how to look. They don't know how to look for tongue and lip tie. They didn't pursue continuing education in it. So he did the procedure. And for us, since I had worked so hard, I had done some oral motor therapy with her. I had done a lot of tummy time with her and some other things at home. We had worked so hard on the latch. For us, we went into recovery room and it was just magic. She latched no problem. It still took a few weeks. Yeah, it still took a few weeks for us to really nail it. When she was sleepy, she would try and slip back to a shallow, crappy latch. And we did see a chiropractor for a little bit. We tried some body work, some craniosacral therapy with the PT. We tried lots of things just to kind of really solidify and finalize that breastfeeding, you know, to get breastfeeding together. So by 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks after the procedure, we were in a really good place. Her feedings went down from 45 minutes to 5 to 10 minutes. I had a scale at home because I wouldn't have believed she was being fed enough otherwise. But she was getting more ounces. She was getting about 3 ounces in 5 to 10 minutes before she had been getting 1.5 to 2 ounces in 45 plus minutes. So it was a game changer for us. And that's when I realized, you know what? I'm really passionate about this and I want to help other moms because I went through hell. So, and I just felt that OT, I just felt that we were so well suited. to work in that space and to navigate all the things that come up, the trauma that can happen for labor delivery. But I did go to therapy, and I really wanted to make sure that I was working on myself so that I wasn't treating from a place of, you know, my own grief and trauma and disappointment. And I wasn't treating in a way that was anecdotal. I wanted to be evidence-based and to look at every mom objectively as much as possible, while also connecting with her on a human level. So that was pretty much my journey. And I ended up finishing out the requirements to become a board certified lactation consultant. I finished those up only last June, 2019. And I barely missed the deadline for the October exam. I was super disappointed about that. And at this time, though, my confidence in the letters were wavering. You know, my confidence in the IBCLC letters were wavering just because I had seen four people who couldn't help me. It was really frustrating. I knew that there were some good IBCLCs out there, but then I knew there were a ton of not good ones. And I wasn't sure why until I finished my own training. I realized that training is not that rigorous. It's online, 90 hours online. You can mix and match the hours. It's not, they have some accredited programs. I took an accredited program, but you don't have to. Whereas in OT school, you have to take mental health classes and PED classes and, you know, anatomy and physiology. It's very specific what you have to take. It's a curriculum, and the schools are accredited to make sure that each class has certain, you know, things in it. It's not like that for IBCLC. And the minimum requirements are it's just a high school degree and then 14 college classes, which can be taken online. So there are a lot of IBCLCs out there with just a high school degree. And I feel bad when I say just. I say that because I know how hard I worked for my OT degree. You know, 7 years of school, 6 years of school, I guess. And just so much studying, so many exams, so much stress. Even the process of getting in is so rigorous. It's not rigorous for IBCLC. And then a lot of nurses, people who work in the hospital, they count for their clinical lactation hours. I say this, I hope it's not offensive, but basically they count every hour they spend breathing the same air as a breastfeeding mom. So whether they're shoving heads onto breasts or really being helpful, they count those hours as their lactation hours. Which is why, unfortunately, a lot of the hospital nurses, they kind of have a reputation of not being that great with breastfeeding, with lactation, although they do have the letters IBCLC. It ticks a box for the hospital to have IBCLCs on staff so they can get certain designations like baby-friendly designations. And that's not to say there aren't really good lactation consultants in the hospital. It's just more often than not, moms report that the lactation consultants weren't very good. So then I met all the requirements for IBCLC. I still wanted to take it. I kind of felt like you have to pay to play, you know, and I wanted to be one of the good ones, one of the good board certified lactation consultants. So I barely missed the deadline for the October exam. And then this March exam has been postponed indefinitely. So I'm not technically board certified yet, although I'm an OT and a certified breastfeeding specialist. However, I found that hasn't made a difference for my private practice. By reputation, my practice has grown. I sort of started off, I launched my private practice last July, actually, right after I'd met the requirements, just so that I felt I could see moms and charge them and give them a super bill with my NPI number and all of that. And I don't know, I was just nervous. I felt that I needed to wait until I at least had the CBS letters, the certified breastfeeding letters. Certified breastfeeding specialist letters to launch my private practice for breastfeeding. So again, I wanted to just see maybe a mom a month, a mom a week, just to see how it went. And I was probably going to go back to a school. I'd worked at another school too. I was actually working alongside finishing out my lactation hours. I was working just 2 days a week. And then I was working like 20 hours a week for free with moms to get the lactation hours I needed for IBLC. It was a lot. And luckily my husband was very supportive. But because I had helped so many moms for free, I already had referral sources. So they were telling their friends about me and they were so excited that I thought of a business name and I was official. And, so I ended up getting a lot more referrals than I thought I would. And I was getting referrals from doulas and midwives. And I sort of, my practice grew from there, to the point where I was not full-time. I didn't want to work 40 hours a week. I wanted to work like 30 hours a week, 75% time, because I wanted to be around my daughter and have a little bit more flexibility but I did get to that point quickly by October, November. And I ended up having a wait list where I couldn't see all the moms that were calling me. So that was really cool. And basically, a lot of my clients would come to me with tongue tie and lip tie where people missed it, like I experienced. People missed it, or babies would have laryngomalacia or tracheomalacia or just different situations, low tone that made breastfeeding more complicated. Baby was born early, didn't have sucking pads. So I kind of got this reputation for being able to take on some of the harder cases. So people would see two or three IBCLCs and then see me. And some of them liked that I wasn't an IBCLC because they had been frustrated with the IBCLCs that they saw. So it was very interesting. And
so honestly, I have so many comments for you. But first, I just want to say, like, you have so much knowledge, and it is so clear to me how passionate you are about this area of OT. I just am blown away, and I completely agree with you. You don't need any letters right now. Like, oh my God, just go treat help. Like, you're incredible.
You're so sweet.
And also, like, your kind of traumatic birth experience, I do think that that is really powerful that you're able to, like, take that and help people from that lens. So can I ask you a couple questions?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I'll just start over here. So for the ILBAC, how much does that cost to get? And in the hospitals, do you have to be a nurse in order to treat as an ILBLC, or can you be a OT or another practitioner?
That's a great question. So the letters are so confusing. It's IBCLC. Everyone butchers it, and I butchered it for a very long time. IBCLC. That's a great question. So in the hospitals, it depends on the state you're in. So in the Northeast, mostly they want to see RN/IBCLC. In California, there's actually a swallowing certification that only OTs can get. And that's, I think it's through AOTA. So they're feeding specialists in the hospital, in the NICU, and even with adults, the ones doing the swallowing studies are OTs. It's very different in California. So there are a lot of OT IBCLCs in the NICU and in the hospital. There are two amazing OT IBCLCs in I think it's Seattle Children's, Lynn Wolf and Robin Glass. They are kind of the OG OT IBCLCs. They became IBCLCs in the year 2000. I was very fortunate to interview Lynn Wolf recently, actually, for a project we have coming up with one of my businesses, which we can elaborate more on that later. But they both work in a level 4 NICU, Lynn Wolf and Robin Glass, which is unusual. They see the sickest of the sick babies, and they have 80 therapists in their NICU. I believe it's 80, only OTPT. And a lot of them are IBCLC. I don't know exactly how many. However, being an OT IBCLC, specializing in infant feeding, they can work with mom in a way that other feeding therapists, other OT, SLP, PT feeding therapists just can't. Feeding therapy training is more focused on bottle feeding or oral motor therapy too. And a lot of feeding therapy classes are geared more towards solids and beyond. So like 6 months and beyond. Getting those IBCLC letters can be helpful for the hospital setting. And it's actually quite easy if you already work in the NICU, because you are breathing the same air as breastfeeding moms, and you can count those hours. Hopefully you're helping those breastfeeding moms and not disappointing them and letting them down. But there's not a practical component. So you asked how much it costs. Okay. So for IBLCE, for OTs, we're one of, I think it's 9 approved licensed healthcare providers that can go through this special pathway. Well, there are 3 pathways. They're all special in their own way, but we can go through pathway 1. Pathway 1 for a licensed healthcare provider, we don't have to take any college classes because it's assumed that within our programs, we already took anatomy. I think anatomy and physiology are requirements. I could be wrong. We already took biology, development course, all of the, there's 14 again. We already took those courses, statistics, ethics, things like that. So all we have to do is pursue 90 hours of online lactation education. You can get a lot of it for free. Different LSERPs for free. LSERPs is what lactation's continuing ed is called. Like, we have our CEUs for OT school, but it's LSERPs for lactation. you can get some for free here and there from companies like Gold Learning, and then their iLactation, there are others, or you can go through a full accredited program. I think it's LAERCC accredits the lactation programs. I might have switched some of those letters. You can go through a full accredited program. If someone's listening and they're really interested in becoming an IBCLC, I do recommend going through an accredited program. My favorite program is Lactation Education Resources, getting the CBS, the Certified Breastfeeding Specialist. They have a 45-hour and a 90-hour option. So it's great if you just get the 90 hours through LER, one and done. They touch on everything that you need for the IBCLC exam. So it's helping with the studying process too. Although in theory, someone could just take 90 hours on a topic of interest, like inducing lactation and adoption and breastfeeding. That's what I don't like. You know, I think it's important to kind of be a generalist starting out, like with OT school, having the PED classes, having the adult classes. So for breastfeeding, having the low supply classes, having a NICU class, having and the NICU education is limited for IBCLC. It's geared towards more well babies and neurotypical babies, the training. But I just think it's important to be a little bit well-rounded, have some information about oral anatomy and cranial nerves and things like that. So again, I recommend the accredited option. There's also CLC through a few different organizations. That's more well-known. So a lot of people, and I kind of wanted those letters just because they're well-known and it sounds so close to IBCLC. Although it's not a 90-hour option, it's like 52 hours. It's in person, which can be challenging scheduling-wise. Although now with COVID, it's online too. So I know there are a lot of OTs who are going for that because it's online. It's just easier if you have kids at home and don't want to travel. So I think they're both options. And some people will do the CLC and then they go back and do Lactation Education Resources 45-hour option. So they end up with slightly more than 90 hours, like 97 hours. So you need that. So it's the 90 hours and you need, for pathway one, you need 1,000 clinical lactation hours. And those, it's very, it can be confusing when you read the website, which is part of the reason why I spun off and made a new business with my business partner, Darian Roberts, something we can talk about called the Lactation OT. I'll make sure to share more about that if you guys are interested. So we have like free flow charts to help you understand the pathway one and what can count as clinical hours for pathway one, because that's a question we get a lot. But really you can count any time you spend in EI or in the hospital working with a breastfeeding mom. It can be time spent on the phone with a breastfeeding mom, online, doing telehealth with a breastfeeding mom. It's very flexible. Support groups, it doesn't have to be one-on-one. It's extremely flexible, which is good and bad, you know? And a lot of people who have worked in maternity or a NICU, they already have their 1,000 hours. They reflect back on the 5 years. They do a little bit of rough math. They already have their 1,000 hours. So all they have to do is take the 90 lactation education hours. And then you apply for an exam. So the 90 lactation hours probably cost about between 500 and 1,000. The LER program has a great 20% discount. If you find the group on Facebook, LER group discount or something, you can contact me and I can point you in the direction. that program is almost 1,000, but with the discount, it's like 750 or something. So that's great for the 90 hours. And then the exam itself is about $650 or $660 to apply for. And it's offered twice a year in person at like a Prometric where we took our board exam for OT. Prometric. And it's twice a year. You have to apply like 6 to 8 months in advance of taking the exam though. And then they approve you based on, you know, have you met the criteria. Pathway two, there's three pathways. Pathway two is only if you go through 5 universities and get a bachelor's along this path of lactation. So that's not really applicable for OT. And then pathway three is applicable for OT, but it's a little more, it's harder to go on that pathway. It's only 500 hours of lactation hours instead of 1,000, but you have to have an assigned mentor and the mentor has to be a board certified lactation consultant. Any board certified lactation consultant will do. You just have to sign a contract with them and you can have multiple mentors. It's not limited to one or two. I think it's unlimited how many mentors you can have. They just have to sign a contract, which you upload to IBLCE's website. And then you get 500 hours somewhat supervised from them. They don't have to be in the room with you, but they're keeping track. Maybe you do some shadowing with them at first. You can't count the shadowing hours as your lactation hours. But a lot of people end up paying for that. So for the 500 supervised hours, some IBCLCs will charge nothing. Maybe they'll have you just help them with their practice, kind of intern with them. Some will charge like $1 an hour. So that's $500. Some will charge upwards of $30 an hour. So it gets very expensive. I can't do math, but you know, it can be like $10,000-$20,000 maybe for the pathway three, which is cheaper than OT school for sure. But it's hard because you have to get the contract signed and then it's prospective. The hours are prospective. And, with OT, it seems to make a lot of sense to go through pathway one. Although they just made it recently where you can have a pathway three mentor who's out of state. So that's definitely going to open a lot of doors. It used to be, you try and find someone in your area, and what I hear is that a lot of doors are slammed in faces for OTs in particular. So OTs will reach out to IBCLCs in the area. A lot of them are not licensed healthcare providers because IBCLC is only licensed in 2 states. So they are your classic IBCLC non-RN who went through, a lot of them go through pathway three, or they go through pathway one through organizations like La Leche League, Breastfeeding USA, and they take the college classes. So, but basically a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of OTs interested, cold call, cold email, I guess, multiple IBCLCs who tell them, no, we're not interested. We don't really want to, you know, be your mentor for whatever reason. So there are just a lot of doors slammed in faces. So that's part of the reason why I started the Lactation OT, to open doors and help, because there are, we have something really amazing to offer, something really special to offer. If we truly are passionate and really want to become an expert in this, what unfortunately a lot of OTs and SLPs and PTs, we get a bad rep in the lactation community for taking the quickie 5-day course and thinking we're breastfeeding experts. And then we give crazy advice to parents like sandwich your breast so your baby doesn't suffocate while breastfeeding, just stupid things. Because we don't know, but we say with confidence because we're licensed and it is in our scope technically. It's actually squarely within our scope. I've analyzed the practice framework. This is very much within our scope to treat both mom and baby. So unfortunately, we do get a bad rep. So we have to work on that and make sure that if we're going to work with breastfeeding families, we are offering, you know, evidence-based care. And
hey, everybody, I am so genuinely excited to tell you about MedBridge. So MedBridge is a continuing ed site, and they have tons of continuing ed courses all available online. You can stream them at your own pace. They also have home exercise plans, which are incredible. You can literally build your own plan with pictures that can perfectly suit whatever client you're working for. It's honestly so awesome. And you get unlimited CEUs. And these CEU courses are just really intriguing and exciting. Like, I've done continuing ed online in the past, and these ones that they select are just very much in line with what I find interesting, and I feel like you might find them interesting as well. So, are you struggling with finding the resources for your time for CEUs? With almost 2,000 accredited evidence-based streaming courses, live CEU webinars, MedBridge is your all-in-one solution. And actually, if you use my code, it's SPILLTHEOT, capital S, capital T, capital OT. So SPILLTHEOT, one word, capital S, capital T, capital OT. You can get $175 off of your year-long subscription, which is awesome. I mean, that's like significant amount of money off. So if you are interested, please go check it out. Again, use the code SPILLTHEOT, capital S, capital T, capital OT, all one word. All right. I really hope that you go check it out. Enjoy.
Top level, you know, expert level care.
Okay. Thank you so much. So I just want to make sure I understand clearly. What would your best advice be for somebody who's either a new grad or somebody who's already an OT and trying to get into this setting? Would you send them down the IBCLC pathway one, or would you send them
more towards continuing education, shadowing opportunities, working with a mentor? Like, what would your advice be to somebody who just wants to start the process? Like, where would you send them first?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, so the first thing I would say, and this is obviously I'm shouting out my business. So the first thing I would say is join the Lactation OT community on Facebook. That's step one, in my opinion, because you can get a lot of free resources from us, and then just join a community of over 500 therapists. And we've grown this community from 0 to 500 in just about a month and a half, 2 months. We just announced. We planned this starting probably a year ago, and then we got serious about this business last October, and then we announced it March 31st, and it has just exploded. There are so many OTs.
It's so clear that there's a need for this then. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So join the Lactation OT community for sure on Facebook, get on our email list, start getting our free resources. We have an amazing summit coming up June 22nd. Join the summit. You can get a free ticket for that if you are going to listen every single day. Do the free ticket. And if you don't have time to listen Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday to all 10 interviews, because each day they are available for only 24 hours, then you want to get the all access pass, which is going to let you listen to the interviews again and again and again for a year. And we are including a lot of templates and checklists, additional bonus content, bonus interview content in those interviews. And the people we're interviewing are experts in the field. One of them is Lynn Wolf, who is one of the OG, you know, OT, original OT IBCLCs. So you want to listen to that, because everyone tells you about their story, their path, you know, because everyone's path is a little different. So you want to do both of those things, I think. The OT Lactation, the Lactation OT Summit, the Lactation OT community, for sure. That'll help you get a sense for what you might want to do. I think if you're coming at this only working with adults, then it's so important to start taking some pediatric courses and to get a mentor, because this is firmly rooted in pediatrics. It really, really is. Especially as an OT, we're expected to be experts in child development and infant development. When we are working with breastfeeding dyads, we're expected to help, you know, babies meet milestones, and we're expected to know a lot about infant reflexes and infant oral anatomy, which is different than adult oral anatomy. So you gotta take a lot of pediatric courses, start taking some feeding therapy courses. I wouldn't recommend taking all the courses at the same time. So maybe start with the lactation course just to see if you're interested. Maybe start with a free lactation course. And then if you are interested and you want to pursue that, I recommend starting with either a 45-hour or a 90-hour program. And then maybe once you're halfway through, maybe then add on some feeding therapy courses. We're going to have courses on the Lactation OT. So depending on when this happens, maybe adding on our courses, because our courses are 100% about the breastfeeding dyad, versus if you take a feeding therapy course, it's usually ages 0 to 3, and maybe 5 to 10% of the course is going to be applicable to breastfeeding infants and infants 0 to 6 months. So you end up paying a lot of money for not a lot of information that you can take and use right away. Again, that's one of the reasons why we made the Lactation OT. But you want to take those courses, feeding therapy, oral motor therapy. You want to take some body work courses, like maybe myofascial release or craniosacral therapy down the line. I think not everyone wants to take those courses. I feel like the feeding therapy, the oral motor therapy, those are required in a way if you want to be that infant feeding specialist, infant feeding expert in your community. The body work courses, you can refer out for that. So if you don't want to do like manual therapy, myofascial release, craniosacral therapy, you can refer out to another OT or PT or to a licensed massage therapist, chiropractor, etc. But you know, it's helpful to take one of those classes, like an intro, just so you understand how to evaluate for fascial restriction. So there are a lot of classes to take, but basically in terms of pathway one versus pathway three, if you're coming at this from adults, you're not seeing patients. You're not seeing enough breastfeeding moms where you can start racking up to 1,000 hours. Some people working with adults will go through La Leche League Breastfeeding USA. That's a choice. That's an option. That works well for some people. It can take many, many years though with either of those. Breastfeeding USA and La Leche League, it can take like 4 years. You have 5 years to get all the clinical hours. Regardless of whether you pick pathway one or pathway three, I do recommend having mentors along the way. I did, and it was so, so crucial. Even though I was pathway one, I had a lot of mentors. You definitely want to shadow no matter what, and ideally shadowing different settings, private practice, maybe if they'll let you in the hospital, shadow in the hospital. You want to see babies with different diagnoses, neurotypical babies, babies born early, babies born around their due date. You want to see a lot. And pathway three, it can be tricky. It can be tricky to find a mentor. We're going to try and make that process easier through the lactation OT. So more information about that will be coming, especially now that you could technically work with someone out of state. As a mentor, we want to try and help people match up for pathway three. But it really just depends. I think studying the pathways, studying our flow chart is going to help you pick your pathway. It's going to help you figure out, you know, what your timeline is like and how can you get 500 hours? Can you get 1,000 hours? Who will your mentors along the way be? And then do you really want to do this? Because I think some people are just really passionate about women's health and maybe they realize they want to do pelvic floor, you know, and that's actually their interest. In which case, I highly recommend checking out Lindsay Vestal with a functional pelvis. Join the Women's Health OT group. There are amazing OTs who specialize in pelvic health and pelvic, you know, pelvic floor therapy that can help you. But if you really, really, really want to do lactation, just know it's strongly rooted. It's very much rooted in pediatric practice as well. It's pediatric. It's probably more pediatrics, honestly, because the mom wants to talk about the baby constantly, you know? So you're helping her by helping her in her role as a mother, and helping her be confident.
That is extremely helpful. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And then will you be able to send me the information for your summit? And then I'll include that in the show notes.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. So can you tell me a little bit about your business and just how you ended up putting this together? Because you have an OT background, not a business background. So what was that process like? And then what do you do? Like, what does an average day for you look like?
So my private practice is called Lactation and Development Resources. Feel free to check out my website. I'm sure we'll include it somewhere, but it's www.lactdev.com, LACTDEV.com for lactation development. I built it myself, my website, after a lot of trial and error. I started on WordPress and then I ended up with Squarespace, and I'm really happy with Squarespace. And I learned a lot through building my website. My dad actually does that professionally. He builds websites for people on WordPress, which is why I really wanted to make WordPress work. He helped me a bit too. But Squarespace is just more my jam at the end of the day. And it's more drag and drop, and it's just easier for most people. You don't have to be a high level developer. So I think for me, I didn't have a website starting out. I had to learn a lot about business. I listened to the Mind Your OT Business podcast with Laura Figueroa. So shout out to her. Check out her podcast, because you have to get into this business mindset, which is really challenging as an OT. We just want to help everyone, and we feel bad accepting money and setting our prices, which, you know, is understandable. But at the end of the day, I forget who said this. It might have been Laura Figueroa or maybe even Melissa LaPointe. She's another person who's really big in the women's health community. She's a business coach. One of them, or both of them, or someone else they quoted, I don't know, say that if you're not making a profit, it's a hobby. It's not a business. You have to make profit and be able to pay yourself for it to really be a business. At the end of the day, otherwise you're a volunteer and you're working for free, you know? So that I had to get into this business mindset and make goals for myself. I had to decide, do I want to have an LLC or a DBA, which is a long decision. It also depends on your state. So I definitely recommend talking with your accountant and your lawyer to figure that out. Thinking of a business name. A lot of people use their own name for their business, which is fine. And it works really well for a lot of people. It's actually a great idea. Unless you're thinking of group practice down the line, then you don't want to do that because there are going to be other OTs or CODAs or SLPs or whoever in your group practice. So I think that's important consideration when you think of a name, which I imagine one day I would like a group practice. So that's why I didn't use my name and I kept it pretty general, Lactation and Development Resources. So I picked a name. I ended up doing a DBA in New York after a lot of consideration. I did not do an LLC in New York when I was living in New York. And once I had those in place, I got a business bank account, which is really important. You don't want to mix your personal and your business finances. So you get a business bank account. I qualify for a business credit card. You have to use an EIN tax ID. So not your social security number. You have to register through the IRS for an EIN. It's very easy and it's free. It takes like 30 seconds on their website, but that's kind of like your business's social security number. So you get that, go to the bank, you give them your business license, DBA, LLC, whatever, and you give them your EIN and they set up a business account for you. They also want your social security number to make sure that you are, you know, you have good credit. Then you open your business account. And so I made sure the first check I got went into my business account because it's very important to separate your personal and your business finances. You pay yourself from your business. You're an employee of your business, even if it's just you. You don't want to mix the two. So it helps that my husband's a lawyer because he helped advise me on all of this. But you want to get your consent forms for sure. Speaking of lawyers, you want to get your consent forms. You want to make sure that you are dotting all your I's, crossing all your T's, following your state laws for private practice. As OTs, we're allowed to work in private practice. You have your insurance. Your insurance company knows, your therapy insurance company knows that you have a DBA now or an LLC because they're going to probably charge you more and, you know, adjust your policy as a result. If you have an office space, you need to make sure that there's a general, I think it's like a general liability or something. Your insurance company will know. They need to basically have like an additional thing for the physical location that you're renting at your office in case someone were, they call it like a slip and fall policy sometimes, but basically in case someone were to slip and fall in the office space, you know, you need to make sure that you're covered for that. Some people get additional insurance too. Again, something you want to talk with your accountant or lawyer about. But basically, like getting all your dots in a row takes a very long time. And then once all of that is together, I just made a Facebook page, a Facebook business page, and an Instagram. I was not going to make a website right away because, again, I was only going to see one mom a month. I didn't need a website. And I was only going to have a few word of mouth referrals because I was still like not so confident because I didn't have the IBCLC letters. But ultimately, I did make a website. I wanted moms to be able to book online so I didn't get a million phone calls. I use Acuity Scheduler, which is really common with a lot of private practices. It's a great scheduler. You can use it for free or $15 a month or more than that. But basically, like, you just want to make sure all your ducks are in a row and then come up with your policies for your business, boundaries, especially with lactation. You know, moms will contact you constantly. They'll text you and call you constantly. And you have to make sure that you're carving out that time for work and you're carving out time for your family. Because otherwise you're going to work all the time and your husband or wife or partner, domestic partner, whoever, and your kids are going to get a little resentful and jealous, understandably so, if you're working, you know, 120 hours a week or something crazy. Like I ended up using Spruce to get a second line on my phone because it was too stressful for me to see my little like red numbers go up. 2 messages, 10 messages from clients. So I have a separate line and I make it so that I get phone calls from that line, but only, I think I limited the time only between like 9 a.m. and 7 p.m. I'm pretty sure I did that on Spruce. And then I made it so I don't see any notifications. I just go in and check it 3 times a day. That's it. And clients can message with me. It's HIPAA compliant and encrypted, which is important. So you have to offer your clients secure messaging option. They don't have to use it, but you have to offer it. So I offered that. Oh, also a G Suite email is important for HIPAA compliance. You sign a BAA, I think, with G Suite. So you get the G Suite and then you make sure that you sign the thing that you need to sign to make it HIPAA compliant. You can store patient files on your Google Drive if it's a G Suite drive only. Otherwise, it's not compliant. So I learned a lot. I made a lot of mistakes. And I purchased Annie Frisbee's lactation toolkit, which really helped with getting my EHR set up, my electronic health record system set up. It was like almost, I think it was $375, Annie Frisbee's toolkit. I do think it's well worth it. And, you know, maybe eventually for a lactation OT, we'll create something similar because I did have to change her templates a lot to fit OT because her templates are for IBCLC and we our evaluations are different and more, you know, we're looking at the whole body head to toe and our assessments are different. Our assessment tools are different. Our requirements for note taking are different. And then if you are submitting to insurance, the codes are all different.
That is so crazy helpful. I can't even tell you. You're teaching me tons and tons.
Oh, thank you.
So do you have all your patients do private pay or do they go through insurance through you or you just kind of give them the super bill?
That's a great question. And it's something I've gone back and forth on for a long time and I've racked my brain over and I've called colleagues and friends and because I started out of network, cash pay, but I would give a super bill. Actually, I don't know if it's considered cash pay if you're giving a super bill, but basically out of network and I would provide a super bill, which has like that itemized list of, you know, CPT codes and the price. And I made sure it said very boldly, you know, patient already paid me, you know, please remit payment to patient. Because sometimes these insurance companies will try and send you the money, which you don't want because you were already paid. So that's how I've done it from the beginning. That's actually how lactation consultants typically do it. They're pretty much all out of network. So it's not shocking for parents. That's what I do. I really almost went in network about a month ago. I was on the phone. I actually filled out the CAQH, I think is what it's called, and the entire application for an insurance company. And then I ended up talking with a colleague of mine, and she was telling me about how it works on her end and how she manages it. She finds it very easy, but when she was showing it all to me, I knew that was not for me, and it was going to start to make me resentful because it involved a lot of calling the insurance company, checking the benefits, all of those things. And what she was being reimbursed was less than what I'm charging. And my sessions are long. My evals are about 2 hours, which is pretty common for lactation. When I was starting out, my evals were 3 hours because you're evaluating two people and you're evaluating the relationship between them, right? The dynamic between them, the breastfeeding. It takes a long time. I've gotten quicker over time. And I've also learned that it's better to do a follow-up, you know, session instead of trying to cram everything into the first session because it can be overwhelming for moms because you do evaluate and you start treatment in the first session for lactation because the mom is in a really desperate state and you can't just evaluate and say, see you in a week. You know, that's not going to fly. You have to start treatment at the same time, the same session. So yeah, I'm out of network. In Texas, I'm still cash pay. I'm still giving a super bill. I might start asking moms if they want a super bill before I go through the effort of making one, because I would say 80% of my clients don't ever submit it. And I only see moms like between 2 times and 6 times. I have not seen a mom more than 6 times before. Babies change so fast. And if I just personally feel if you can't help them and if you're not seeing progress every single session, that means I'm not the right person for them. I need to refer them out. And I have seen babies that, you know, I did suspect CP, like a, you know, some kind of birth injury, cerebral palsy. And those babies, I always refer to EI because it's going to be a long road. And I don't expect mom to pay me all this money to see me weekly. Mm-hmm. If I was in network, sure. If it's going to cost them nothing, sure. You know, but I like focusing on breastfeeding and lactation, and I want to max optimize that as much as possible. And then refer them out because that baby's probably going to struggle with solids and probably going to struggle with gross motor milestones and fine motor milestones if they have, you know, cerebral palsy or Down syndrome or whatever.
Sure. So do you ever see women while they're still pregnant, like in anticipation for afterbirth, or do you always see them postpartum?
That's a really great question. My favorite type of appointment is a prenatal appointment. It really is. My passion is prenatal. Honestly, as much as I have honed my skills working postpartum with moms, I much prefer if those moms that I'm working with postpartum met me when they were pregnant. It's better for everyone, you know? So I love prenatal visits, and I usually only see moms once. I offer group classes. Obviously with COVID, it's been a challenge. And then I offer private, and a lot of moms will hit me up for a private prenatal session. I also allow people to buy it as a gift card for someone's, you know, baby shower. And so I have had people do that who know me and who worked with me. They get it for a friend.
I love that. What a great idea.
Yeah, those are amazing sessions. I have a little curriculum that I take them through, I guess. It's a PowerPoint that I take everyone through. And then we talk about their specific medical history. And I look at their breasts if they're comfortable. No one has said no yet. But I always ask, is it okay if I do perform a little breast exam? And we talk about your nipple shape and your areola shape, your breast shape, so we can try and start anticipating potentially how it's going to go with latch. So we can talk about, okay, so you do have flat nipples, or they're very short, or, oh, you know, whatever it is. Okay, they were pierced before. Let's talk about how that's going to change things. You had a breast surgery. This was the kind of breast surgery. This is how it could impact. Those are all things you learn in your lactation training about breast surgeries and how it impacts the ability to make milk and breastfeed. So we do that. And I find those moms, I give them a plan for the first 3 days that I've honed over time, like a protocol of sorts. And those moms are the most confident. And those moms, some of them don't even hire me postpartum. I have a really great testimonial I'll just add it to my website of a mom I saw prenatally, never heard from her again. I wasn't sure what happened. She contacted me when the baby was 2 or 3 months old and said, they've been exclusively breastfeeding. Everything's great. I prepared them. They didn't need any help postpartum. I was just so excited because that's really the goal, is that they don't need me or really anyone postpartum because they had a plan and it worked and things came together.
So if you had somebody who you saw during prenatal Would that count as their evaluation? So when you were able to see them postpartum, would you have to do a full evaluation because now there's the baby, or would you consider that more of like a treatment session?
That's a good question. We definitely can jump into treatment sooner, but I still say I'm performing a full evaluation because I ask a lot of questions about labor and delivery. And about the first 3 or 4 days. With my prenatal sessions, though, I should mention this, if it's a private, not if it's a group, but if it's a private prenatal session, I also include the first 3 days after birth. They can text me and call me. Wow. Within reason.
That is so generous of you with your time. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So that helps too. And we'll go back and forth. And I do set boundaries on that. I say, you know, it'll take me 4 to 6 hours to respond to your message. And I can't go to the hospital because I'm not a hospital employee, but we can talk, you know, on the phone or text. They usually only contact me like once a day because they're so busy with what's going on in the hospital or with their home birth. If it's a home birth, I can come over sooner, but I do that. And then I just recently launched an online prenatal breastfeeding course, which has been really, I've gotten great feedback for that. And it's my like signature PowerPoint that, you know, what I already put together. It's obviously not personalized because I don't have mom's medical history if I don't know who she is and she's just taking my online class. But I do offer with that online class, if they want to pay, I think I'm only saying like $10 or $15. If they want to also have a 15-minute phone call with me after the class to ask their personal questions. So that's been great. And I'm able to charge a lot less for that than for my in-person, because it's not my hours. I can be sleeping while someone's taking that class.
Sure. That's amazing. I love everything that you're doing. Thank you so much for doing this. Where can people find you, follow you? What's the best way? Through your website or through Facebook?
Either way, whichever people prefer. My website, I gave that out. There's a contact page you can fill out on there, which gets sent straight to my email. You can email me too. You can go on my Facebook. You can follow my Instagram if you'd like. That's at LactDev, just like my website. Go on the Lactation OT. I'm there too, chatting with professionals because I have, you know, the two businesses. It's like parent facing is lactation and development, and then professional facing is the Lactation OT. So that's divided into two different businesses. Feel free to reach out to me. Yeah, that's how I can be reached.
Amazing. I love everything that you're doing. It's incredible. I had no idea it was going to be so detailed, and I feel like we've just hit like the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
But it's amazing, and I'm so glad that you're advocating for our profession and you're available to bring more OTs into it. And as evidenced by going from 0 to 500 in a month and a half. I mean, clearly there's a lot of people who have an interest in this, and now you can help them and show them how to get to do what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm so excited about it. I mean, I guess the one thing I want to say is this, I'm practicing OT still, because the one question I get is, oh, so you're not an OT anymore. And that breaks my heart because I intertwine OT in everything I do. And I am an OT who specializes in lactation. Just like you can be an OT who specializes in hand therapy or low vision, you're still an OT. That's your first thing, is you're an OT.
Yes. Yes. I'm glad that you said that. And I didn't realize about California that pretty much they all have to be OTs. So I think that's evidence enough that shows that this is absolutely within the scope of OT, and it is still OT. It's just a specialty.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Everybody, thanks for listening. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, want to come on the podcast, please email me at spilltheot@gmail.com. Please follow me on Instagram at spill_the_OT. If you like this podcast, please rate and review it on iTunes and share it with a friend. Thanks. Bye.